And our special guest tonight is Eldon Taylor. Now, what if you awoke tomorrow with amnesia? No memory of who you are and what you like and dislike and so on. Would you be the same person? And what if, as in the movie of The Matrix, you discovered that everything was a simulation and that you were just a program component? What if everything you believed was false? And then who would you be? Tonight on Coast to Coast, we'll be talking with Eldon about his latest work, What If? The Challenge of Self-Realization. Eldon's back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, I'm looking forward to our discussion with Eldon Taylor tonight. Eldon has been researching the power of the mind for years, I mean years, and is considered to be an expert in the areas of hypnosis and subliminal communication. He's the president director of Progressive Awareness Research. He's developed, he's patented the inner talk technology, which has been demonstrated by numerous universities to be effective. We'll talk a little bit about that. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, the Coast to Coast favorite, by the way, Eldon Taylor. Eldon, how are you?
I am excellent, Mr. George Neary. How's the number one radio host in America?
Doing okay.
Doing okay. You sound great. You really sound good, sir.
Well, I'm. You know what? You taught me a long time ago that 90% of whatever you do, you better enjoy it first and foremost.
You know, now I doubt I taught you that, but how very, very true it is. How very, very true. And I can't imagine doing something that's more fun than what you do, but then I can't imagine somebody bringing more passion, more excitement to it than what you bring. And when you put that together, it's no wonder you're the number one guy on the planet.
What the heck?
Now, I have to ask this before we get started.
Sure.
The last time we talked, you were thinking about a run for president. You were serious.
Yeah, there was a group of individuals who seriously wanted me to make the plunge, and at that time, you know, I'm pretty nonpartisan. You know, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a libertarian. I call it the way I see it. I mean, I'm a staunch supporter of our military, but I'm not a warmonger.
Right.
I'm conservative, but I think that we should be developing special social programs for people. So, you know, I'm a hodgepodge of everything. Well, anyway, this group knew of what my views were, and because we have so many millions of listeners, they thought, you know, this guy can win a couple primaries right away, and then, you know, he's on his way, and we like his views. We've listened to him on the radio. We're comfortable with him, and he seems like a straight shooter. And so they kick that around, right?
Uh-huh.
And you know, I said, you know, let's see what would happen. But, you know, the problem with that is it brings, one, high risk. You know, if you don't win, you have to step down. You can't do what you're doing. And, you know, you got to hit the campaign full time.
Right.
And as much as there's some things I would love to do for this country, Eldon, I just figured it wasn't time to do that. So with 2012 right around the corner now, I would say it's very unlikely I will take that plunge. But it was, I got to tell you, it was an honor. And I got a couple write-ups and some national media, and yeah, it was kind of intriguing.
Exciting thought. And you call it a hodgepodge. You say, you know, it's a hodgepodge, but what it is honesty, integrity. That's what it comes down to. It's not a pundit standing on a platform that he has to cater to in order to carry a certain element of a party. And I think that's what America is ready for.
I think so, too. Somebody somewhere has got to tell Americans the truth, lay it out there for them, be very honest about what's going on, and try to come up with solutions to get these problems fixed. And at the same time, understand that this planet is going through one heck of a change, and we need to do something for humanity. It sounds like I'm running, but I'm not.
But that is absolutely correct. I mean, if there was ever a time that we should be looking at, you know, the old Kennedy notion, what is it we can do for our country as opposed to what the country is going to do for us, it's now.
You've got
it's
some.
It's not just our country, it's our neighbors, you know.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
So anyway, you've got some great work out here. What If, The Challenge of Self-Realization, what does that mean? Exploring mind, meaning, and mystery. What's been new with you? I mean, we haven't talked for a little over a year.
No, you know, of course, I've been, you know, busy as usual. We've got a couple of new studies underway, and I'm you know, glad that we're able to provide the stipend that's necessary for a couple of doctoral candidates to actually look at a few things. One of them happens to be, you know, how we process information out of awareness. I ran a pilot study on that many, many years ago where we used a lie detection, actually used a polygraph, and we would the whole study was set up this way. We told subjects that we were very well aware of the soothing nature of music and how it enhanced the relaxation response. We were really interested, however, in whether or not nature sounds also produced that, because there were a lot of people in wives' tales that indicated that, you know, the sound of rain or laying by an ocean, you know, was very soothing. So that's a story we told the subjects. We divided them, of course, into groups, and one group listened to ocean waves, and actually the duration was 3 minutes. And these ocean waves at 1 minute intervals contained a subliminal message, and that message was a benign message. At least we thought it would be benign. It was simply, people are walking. The other group listened to the same content, ocean waves, but at 1 minute intervals, a message came, watch out, danger, danger, danger. And of course, what we wanted to see is, how was that processed? Well, the polygraph was immediate. We saw immediate responses in the subjects that were hearing the danger message, and nothing of any consequence in the subjects listening to people are walking. However, when we debriefed the subject and we asked them about, you know, their reverie, what they were fantasizing, people that were listening and had heard people are walking, all of them were on a beach laying near the ocean, and there were all kinds of people walking by them. Very interesting study. At any rate, we have commissioned a university with the full-blown materials to run a good follow-up study on that with a good number of subjects. So we move it out of the pilot and into the literature. I've been busy doing that. Of course, you know, I've got my own little radio show that you honored me by being a guest on.
I had fun on that.
And you did honor me. I mean, I mean that sincerely. George Nuri doesn't need to go anywhere and be anybody's guest. And I'll tell you, all of the fans at Hay House love you and respect you. That was a great thing for you to do. And I continue to get comments about your interview and the time that you spent with us. So I've been having fun trying to share the word that, you know, like you, now is the time and the place to wake up. You know, we've been pretending long enough. You know, Kurt Vonnegut said, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend. And I'm afraid we haven't been too careful about that.
No, not at all. Are we being manipulated and controlled every day, Eldon, and we just don't realize it?
I mean, the answer to that is an unequivocal, no hesitation, absolute yes. Now, it isn't a matter of are we, it's a matter of to what extent. You know, we sit down in front of the television set, and the hard research shows us that in under 3 minutes, you're going to go into an altered state that we call alpha. That's a slowed brainwave activity. Normal consciousness is beta. Alpha is 8 to 14 cycles per second. And it's the same state that we call a hypnosis state. So you're going to go into this altered state in front of that television set. And in your lifetime, you know, the average person that reaches 65 today is going to have spent 9 years of their lifetime in front of that television set. That seems to me, you know, just unbelievable. But it accumulates on a basis of 3 hours and 46 minutes a day, 52 days of the 52 weeks of the year. So what you're really looking at when you're in front of that television set is you're in a hyper state of suggestibility. That's what I have testified in a court of law as an expert on hypnosis, and that's exactly the definition we would use for hypnosis in a forensic setting. It is a hyper state of suggestibility. What does that mean? Well, it means if I take an ice cube and I suggest to you I'm going to burn you, I touch you on your arm, you will blister because your expectation is so geared for that. So here you are, you're in front of a television set, and what are you taking in now? Well, you're going to take in all of the information. If what you're watching is, you know, entertainment that is violent and aggressive, you're going to take aboard the notions, the ideas that are incorporated in it, such as it's okay to get even. You may even find yourself, you know, using the one-liners or buying the bumper stickers. Go ahead and make my day. I don't get even, I get evener. But what's more, you're also taking in an agenda. Everybody has an agenda, and you know, the world is very sophisticated today about this. I mean, utilizing such things as functional magnetic resonance imaging and positron emission tomography, the PET scans, individuals are actually watched lifetime. Their brain is monitored. While various experiences and stimuli are presented, And in that process, we learn lots of things, some of which are very surprising. Take, for example, a study that was conducted in the United Kingdom now, just about 2 years ago, showed that when you showed a smoker the warning on a pack of cigarettes, the Surgeon Right. General's warning, the nucleus caught it. A reward center in the brain was excited, it lit up, to use the words of fMRI, indicating that that caused the smoker to want to smoke more.
Oh.
Yeah, rather counterintuitive. But so what's the answer to the tobacco companies? Well, we'll blow it up, make it bolder, and put it on more sides of the pack.
Because they knew this. They knew how to react with something like that, so they obviously played to it. And you know what? Who in terms of any legislators or lawyers could fault them? You know, well, the Surgeon General says this is not healthy. We want the world to know that, folks, so we've made it bigger, but they know the secret.
And you are absolutely right, but that is all a part of what Bernays called the propaganda scheme anyway.
Amazing.
You know, if I can deliver information to you that is information you want to hear, and it is logically consistent with why I would be delivering that information, and there is no better example that I can think of than this one right here, well, then, of course, no one's going to challenge it, even if you learn that it causes a smoker to want to smoke more.
You look like a hero unless they have emails that say, let's do this and get them to buy more.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So here you are, you're back, you know, in our television scene, you're in front of the television set, and along comes, you know, the commercial for the Gombu, and it tells you you're going to get it, but don't worry about it. You know, you can run to ABC Pharmacy, you can get XYZ drug, and then you can assume a supine position, and some loved one is going to dote on you. And that's the image that, you know, it's portrayed with. And of course, we buy that lock, stock, and barrel. I think of it as selling sickness. And indeed, we have cases where we've actually been able to verify that there is a one-on-one correspondence to the commercial hitting the airwaves and the onset of reported symptoms or an increase in identification of the dis-ease. For example, I think I may have discussed this one with you before, George, but there's no better example than the restless leg syndrome. When 3 years ago, almost four now, when that commercial hit the air, there was literally no reports of restless leg syndrome. If you look at the data the AMA has, as soon as it hit the air, there was an absolute synodial function. I mean, if you looked at this on a chart, it was a straight line climbing the number of people that reported it. The patent on the drug expired. The commercial came off the air, And bang, back to baseline. Nobody reporting those symptoms.
Well, in the case, for example, of the warning for cigarette smoking, why do people, after they read the warning, still want to smoke and smoke more? Why? What is it about the human mind that does that?
Well, Freud would classify that as a thanatos urge. You know, that is the urge, the death urge. You know, we all walk around with kind of, you know, what I think of as the psychological law of self-exemption. Now, you don't need to go Google that. There is no such thing. It is just how I think of expressing the way people exclude themselves from, you know, being the subject of say, let's take the smoker. The smoker knows all of the woes about smoking, all of the diseases, but to them, it will happen to somebody else, not to me.
Right.
And you know, this happens in many, many areas. Well, according to Freud, this thanatos urge is how we tempt death, how we push the fringes of death, because we're all aware back in the back of our heads that, you know, that's one of those certainties. That's one of those things that could come any minute. We don't want to think about it, but sometimes being alive and really feeling alive requires pressing on the edge of the envelope to those things that are very dangerous. That's why we have people, you know, that do everything from bungee jumping to, you know, you think of the daredevil kinds of things that people do, and they do for the thrill, the adrenaline rush, the charge they get out of it. Freud would classify that to be driven by this thanatos urge, this urge actually that propels us toward death, toward danger, toward the certainty of that. It's kind of, as opposed to run away from it, we run toward it. And that's not all that in common in other areas besides just, you know, death and dying. That is a mechanism, by the way, that is well understood by the neuromarketers today. One of the things that most people have trouble wrapping their head around is, why would an advertiser put demonic, you know, kinds of imagery into their visual ads or, you know, their video ads? Why would they put, you know, things that were satanic or that suggested death or that were, you know, the kind of horrible thing that we just, you know, none of us would really like to consciously recognize? And there are two reasons for that. One is, you know, direct at the thanatos, as we said. The other has to do with an implicit aspect, and that implicit aspect is, if I can create an arousal within you, then I've stimulated you sufficiently that I'll hold your attention or you'll be entertained.
That's
and
true.
There
That's
will
right.
be a memory association. Now, it's critical, media particularly, that they generate an arousal. Otherwise, you're bored. You're bored stiff, okay? So I have to have this arousal. Now, while they're creating the arousal, there's two things that happen. One is I have a heightened state of anxiety. Now, we'll hold that and come back to it in a second, because anxiety in modern man, I mean, our primitive brain knows fight and flight. Our modern brain still knows the fight, unfortunately, perhaps too much so. But the flight for most people is anxiety or depression. I mean, acute depression is complete withdrawal, total flight. So, set that aside. That's one element. The other element is, because they have done this, they have systematically desensitized our threshold of arousal. In other words, it takes more and more, more violence, more sex. I mean, a real graphic to me is Sylvester Stallone's First Blood, made in 1982. It took 29 minutes and 31 seconds for one person, the only person to die in that movie. But in 1985, 69 people died. And in 1988, in Rambo 3, 132 died.
Now, I want to talk with you about that, Alden, because you have said something that is very poignant, that you have to give people more as they get conditioned. Let's find out why. We'll be back. Hey, by the way, on Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time for you Coast Insiders, Rosemary Ellen Guiley will be chatting. As you know, she's an expert in ghosts and dreams and does a phenomenal job, and she'll be talking about some of those subjects for you if you are a Coast Insider. Rosemary Ellen Guiley. When we come back, more with our discussion with Eldon Taylor right here on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon, you are getting into something very fascinating. It's almost like feeding an addiction. Give them a little more. Then they're hooked, aren't they?
That's a fact. And of course, in the process, they are systematically desensitizing our, you know, sensibilities. So, I mean, we see young people today. One of the most recent studies I saw indicates that there is a dramatic decrease in the amount of empathy that teenagers feel or are capable of feeling, at least recognized in this particular study. When you look at what's going on in our society and you see the increase in violence, the increase in incivility, whether it is in the workplace or in the schools or it's in the public forum between politicians in the context of how they address one another, et cetera, all of this, I believe, is traceable to how our sensibilities have been diminished as a direct result of overexposure to more and more of this stimuli designed to desensitize our threshold of arousal. And it goes further than that. I think, you know, you use a good word, addiction. We tend to think of addiction as an outside chemical, you know, something that it's alcohol or it's tobacco or it's cocaine. It's an outside chemical. But we can become very addicted to our own neurochemicals. There are certain neurochemicals that bathe the body given different states. And, you know, anyone that knows a runner knows that they can become addicted to the rush that they get as a result of running. Others can become addicted to adrenaline. You can become addicted to your own dopamine or the other neurotransmitters, including, you know, the endorphins, the body's natural opiates. And all of these are associated with different activities, including our mental state. We were talking about television. When I am in front of that television and I go into alpha, what happens is my brain begins to release the neurochemicals that we think of as the endorphins. And these, you know, this makes me feel good. This soothes my anxiety. And so it's no wonder that people think, you know, I'm going to zone out. I'm going to sit down in front of a television set. It's going to relax me. The other thing that happens is for us, you know, right-handers that are dominantly left brain, there's a complete shift in the hemispheres. We shift from left brain to right brain, and that's part of what triggers off this cascading flow of neurochemicals. Well, because we can become internally addicted, there is an association to these events. So when someone says, well, I feel addicted to TV, well, they probably are. When someone says, you know, I think my child's addicted to gaming, well, they probably are. The fact of the matter is that continual bombardment of information that is designed to keep us involved goes even further than what we typically think about. You know.
Well, and let me ask you this question, Eldon. When the tragedy occurred on 9/11 2001, mm-hmm. we created Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. We went to this horrible color terror system, which right. I was very opposed to.
Right.
Where, you know, as the colors got to red, you knew we were in trouble.
Right.
And it was just this bombardment, this conditioning of people. Mm-hmm. Were they doing that because of exactly what you're talking about right now?
Well, you know, I am not going to, nor should I, answer that question, but I can answer it this way. Is it possible that they did that? Absolutely. Is there a correspondence between efforts to accelerate the war effort and increases in the threat as portrayed in our system? Did we see that as we wanted to increase an engagement or as we wanted to initiate an engagement, the danger at home became greater? Absolutely. Therefore, is it probable that they did that? Well, I'll leave that to all of you to make up your own mind. You know, the bottom line is, if I wanted to manipulate you, if I wanted to take some of your freedoms away, if I wanted you to give those freedoms freely to me, I would have to create a state of fear and then offer you protection.
Yes.
It's that simple.
Because you would never give up those rights on your own.
No, that's correct. And I would never think of authorizing maybe a $1 trillion war unless there was a genuine threat. And we had to do something about that threat. I mean, everybody knows that video news releases, what they call VNRs, were prolific during the Bush administration. And you know, a VNR is actually designed by our PSYOPs people to be used on foreign populations to win the hearts and minds. I'll put that in quotation marks, okay? But they were used back here at home. In fact, the way they were used, the media largely would pick them up and bring them back here and play them as though they were local news. Now, this isn't news. You know, this is a video news release. It's designed to be a piece of propaganda aimed at a foreign country to win hearts and minds.
It's a PR campaign.
It is. It absolutely is. And, you know, here, add this to it, okay? Because this is a good one. Remember we put anxiety over here and set it on the table to come back to it? Well, by keeping everybody in this aroused state, this heightened state of anxiousness, what we've done is create the need. So, you know, if you walk into a bookstore nowadays, you look at the magazine rack, the magazine, you know, one is you're not blonde enough, another is you're not thin enough, and another is you're not wearing the right clothes or you're not driving the right car. I mean, all of this is based on a need. You have this need to conform, to fit in. You otherwise are going to be rejected. So the whole bottom line is, if we can create an anxiety, you're a part of the out group, you are near rejection, then we can sell you the solution. It's kind of like, you know, I have to drown you to sell you the life jacket. And that's a large part of the philosophy. Now, listen, the real danger in that, Philip Zimbardo, past president of the American Psychological Association, summed it all up. When he pointed out that, you know, we found that pathological symptoms may develop in up to one-third of normal participants in the rational process that they're trying to make sense of unexplained sources of arousal.
One-third.
So, now listen, if you think the world's going crazy, you're not far wrong.
Jeez, that's unbelievable. 33 1/3%.
I agree, totally.
Eldon, our special guest tonight is Eldon Taylor. His website, Eldon, ELDONTaylor.com. We're also talking about his latest work, What If? The Challenge of Self-Realization. I gave a speech this weekend in Long Beach before a health conference.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking out over the crowd, and I'm sitting back as I talk to them, wondering what each and every one of them is thinking about their own specific life, you know, their families, their body, whether they feel good or bad, illnesses and things. And I looked at all of them, Eldon, and I said to myself, what is this all about? What, and you've looked at this, you begin to address this. What is the purpose of life? I mean, you know, we wake up in the morning, we eat, we do our thing, we go to work, we come home, we go out. What's it all about?
You know, you to me, you have hit on the real question. And and it's a question that we should all ask ourselves. You and I can talk for hours about the different tools and techniques that are used to manipulate man. And they get very, very sophisticated, and some of them get very, very gross. We can talk about some of the old clandestine operations of our intelligence agencies. You know, what comes to my mind is Jules Romain testifying on behalf of the CIA to Congress and telling them that we now know that we can take a young person and, given sufficient time, we can cause them to kill their aged parents, cook them in a stew, and eat them. I mean, it doesn't get a whole lot grosser than that.
No.
And this is, you know, the result of research. Now, not the kind of research you run on a college campus, not the kind that goes through a human subjects committee, but research. We could talk about all of that. But if we did, we'd be overlooking the real issue. And that issue is what you just mentioned. How do we get people to step out of this, to look at who they've become or who they think they've become, and to attempt to authenticate themselves? To me, that's, you know, that's why I do the work that I do. Yeah, I look at it kind of like this. You know, you open the show with this scene of amnesia, and I open my book that way. If you did wake up tomorrow and you had absolutely no memory of who you were.
What a frightening thought, but that's possible, isn't it?
It is. So you're standing in the front of the mirror, total amnesia. Total. What is the most important thing? What would you want to know or do more than anything?
I would want to know exactly who I was.
Yeah, no kidding. And that answer is so obvious. But, you know, we stand in front of the mirror every day and we don't have any clue who we really are. And by that, I mean, listen, if you had this total amnesia, you wouldn't be interested in the day you were born so much. I mean, you could read all those statistics and they could be about somebody else. They wouldn't have any real meaning. Real meaning comes from identifying who you are inside, not the labels, not the names. You know, if you have complete amnesia and somebody says, "I'm your wife," and you look at them, you may or may not think they're attractive, may or may not be happy about that, may or may not want to accept it, but you're not going to have the feeling that you would have if you weren't amnesic.
You would think you were kidnapped, Eldon, or something, or someone was playing some kind of trick on you.
You really would. You know, indeed, it's to me, it's somewhat analogous to Richard Bach's last book, or most recent book. I understand he's not going to do anymore, but Hypnotizing Maria is the name of it. It actually it sets up a pretty decent line, you know, because in his book he talks about stage hypnosis, and I'm going to stretch this and tailor make it, if you will. I'll put that in quotation marks.
Sure.
But imagine that, you know, you're at a theater, and you know, maybe it's a show in Las Vegas, and you've got this on stage hypnosis going on. And the hypnotist gets a volunteer, hypnotizes him, and then tells him they're in a room. And this room is a 8x8 room. It's made of brick, solid brick. There are no windows, no doors. It's like a bomb shelter. And they have been placed in there, and they're very safe. Nothing for them to worry about. Everything is just great, and they're feeling really comfortable. You know, they're sitting on the floor, and they're leaning against the walls. But there are no walls. You're in the audience, and you're looking at this. And then the hypnotist says to him, you know, just occurred to me, there could be a danger where you are. We need to get you out of there. See if you can find a way out. And the subject begins to search the walls. They're pushing on the walls. In fact, they push so hard on the wall that the way their body, the angle their body's at, they'd have to be hypnotized, or they'd fall flat on their face. And the audience is roaring as they try and climb the walls and push the walls and pound the walls and get more and more frantic about it. And then the hypnotist sees that they are really becoming too upset. And so he essentially says, you know, I'm going to awaken you now. Snaps my finger, or count of three or whatever. And the subject wakes up. Now, here's the moral of the story. I truly believe that a large part of our population, the world population, not just our population, live a life analogous to that subject, hypnotized behind those walls. They have all these self-imposed beliefs about what could or couldn't be, what should or shouldn't be, how they're to live, all these sound bites. In fact, I just think of it as sound bite reasoning that have been imposed upon them. And with that sense of limitation, you know, there's no one to wake them up, no one to clap their hands, no one to count one, two, three, and tell them they're awake. And they remain in that state, bouncing like a ping pong ball between mallets, only the mallets are the sound bites that those people who want to own your thoughts are injecting constantly through the continual stream of media. You know, and when I say that, you know, I was talking to Steve Miraboli the other day, and Steve, you know, I was in law enforcement. You know that. I know you were in the right. Navy. Steve was in the Air Force, and he was military police. And he was telling me that he had a domestic call, and he went on this call. He was like 19 years of age, really fit. Now, Steve's a buff guy now. If you look at him, you know that he's a, you know, he's a bodybuilder. But so they respond to this domestic call. And normally, as you would know, that's usually a dispute between a ma and a pa. But when they got there, it was an 8-year-old boy beating up his mother. So Steve ran in to get this 8-year-old boy. He took a hold of him, and the boy threw Steve on the ground. Steve got up thinking, you know, I must not have had my balance. And he ran back to get this 8-year-old boy, and this 8-year-old boy pitched him again. Then his partner was just laughing. He was humiliated. They finally got the two of them, got a hold of this boy, restrained him, got some cuffs on him. And then he was asking his mother, is this kid, what are you giving this kid? Is he getting steroids or something? The woman said, oh, no, he's on medication, but he doesn't get any steroids. And Steve says, well, on medication, I mean, for what? She's always autistic. And Steve said, well, you know, I've never heard of autism at that point in time, Elvin. So he says, you know, I said, well, do they give him steroids for the autism? Because I still couldn't believe an 8-year-old boy had thrown me around.
It's like an adrenaline rush or something.
Yeah. And the mother said, well, no, he's autistic, and so he just doesn't know he's not supposed to be that strong.
Jeez.
Steve says he's never forgotten that. You know, adrenaline, belief, there is an incredible potential that the human being has. The savants stand up and illustrate that to us with these incredible mathematical skills, incredible memory skills, et cetera, and so forth. There is this incredible potential that exists within the human condition, and yet we bounce off these imaginary walls tied up continually in our soundbite reasoning, going in circles, in my opinion, and never solving a problem. Just, you know, in fact, we should talk about that dissonance. That would be a good place for us to go.
Eldon, in how many, and we'll do that at the top of the hour, how many people are wandering around out there trying to find out just who they are?
Well, my experience would be the vast majority. Something that I hear all the time now is, you know, and more, I don't know who I am. I just don't know who I am anymore. I'm so busy with my job, with parenting, with my finances, with my home, and on and on and on and on. That I think I've lost myself. I think I lost myself some time ago. I just really don't know who I am. I don't get my cow gone moment anymore. And I think that's pervasive. And I believe that that's a part of the scheme and something we should be looking at, too, having to do with how they take our identity from us in their efforts to own our thoughts.
More to come with Eldon Taylor when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.